Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of the transcripts of Donald Trump's calls to foreign leaders early in his administration that indicate a woeful ignorance of world affairs, a delusional obsession with the greatness of his campaign and election victory, and a childlike temperament when confronted with facts and reality. We will speak with two prominent American historians of the presidency and begin with Sean Wilentz, professor of American history at Princeton University, whose latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians. He joins us to provide an historical context on how much Trump has lowered the bar to the point where comparisons with prior presidents do a disservice to our history, since Trump is such a disastrous aberration, so that no matter how much his predecessors have faced the harsh judgment of history and are held in low esteem, it does a disservice to them and to our history to compare them to Trump. Then we will speak with the American political historian who teaches at American University, Alan Lichtman. He is the author of The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President, a system that has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last one when, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. His latest book is The Case for Impeachment, and we will discuss whether Trump's alarming lack of qualification for the job of president that the transcripts reveal could be considered grounds for his impeachment. Then finally, we are joined in the studio by Brian Fogel, the director of the new Netflix documentary opening nationwide, Icarus. He sought to investigate the Lance Armstrong story of doping in sports and the science of cheating the tests for doping. But instead, he uncovered a brazen scheme of state-sponsored cheating that resulted in the hero of the film, a brave Russian whistleblower, having to escape Kremlin death threats by taking his family into witness protection, while the villain behind the cheating scandal was promoted by Putin to be his deputy prime minister. And joining us now is Sean Wilentz, the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he has taught since 1979. His books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and Bob Dylan in America. His latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Wilentz.
Great to be here, Ian.
And the transcripts that were released by the Washington Post on Thursday are extraordinary. They are transcripts of early phone conversations that Donald Trump had in January, shortly after his administration began. And I think it reveals an extraordinarily ignorant, delusional, and, I mean, almost incoherent president who barely has a command of the English language. I mean, as an historian, we've often been told that George W. Bush was down there at the bottom, James Buchanan, who clearly was a disastrous president, and maybe the fact that he was possibly America's first and only gay president makes him more interesting. But in the lexicon of dunces in the Oval Office, this guy we have now, he's breaking all the parameters, isn't he?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I bear some of the responsibility for George W. Bush's reputation, which now I think has to be sharply revised. But, you know, Ian, I think we make a mistake by trying to compare Trump to earlier presidents. Look, he is manifestly unfit for office. That showed in the transcripts. The transcripts show a man who's, you know, trying to run the country the way he ran his real estate syndicate. And, you know, you can be inarticulate and bossy in one, but not as president of the United States. But look, there have been other presidents who have been unfit for office, manifestly. But Trump is of another order. I mean, I think that to compare him even to the worst is to ennoble him, is to give him legitimacy in a way, is to make him part of the American political tradition. He has nothing to do with the American political tradition or any tradition we know of. This has been a break, a sharp break, from what we've seen before. So I don't like to get into comparing because it makes, even compared to Buchanan, even doing that makes Trump look good.
Well, there seems to be an American tragedy, not to mention a massive aberration, that this whole thing has happened. But at the heart of the tragedy, to my mind, is the fact that the people who voted for him, I think, sincerely wanted change. They wanted somebody different. They were sick of this politics as usual and very distrustful of the political elite and the political establishment. And the tragedy is, as you can see from these transcripts, that this guy surely is different. He wants to do things differently, but he's woefully ignorant of everything. You know, he doesn't have the basic grasp of the facts and the context of anything. So it's as though, you know, they voted for change, but they got just this reckless ignoramus who will give you change in the way that an orangutan typing on a typewriter for 100 years might actually put a sentence together.
Well, I don't want to come down too hard on orangutans, but I don't want to come down too hard on his voters, but I don't know that a lot of them were voting for change so much. I think they were voting against as much as they were voting for. They liked Trump because he was going to be a very good against candidate. He was going to take down, you know, the establishment, as it were. And well, the establishment is everybody from, mostly in their case, the liberal establishment. Now, you know, they're going to cheer Trump on as long as he's giving them the finger, giving us the finger. And, you know, they don't care if he's inarticulate. They don't care if he's telling lies. They kind of like the lies. The lies are kind of cool. As long as he is going after us, as long as he is on what they perceive to be their side. So I don't think that, you know, this transcript, for example, is going to make much difference at all. These voters are out for something other than, you know, an articulate president who's going to be able to get something done. They're looking for a guy who's going to kick you know, the America they hate in the rear and in other places, and that's what they like. And every time he does it, they cheer. And that's what this presidency is about.
Well, at this point, this presidency is at the crossroads, and it's clear that there are some people, I suspect it's probably Ivanka and Jared and perhaps even Melania, that are trying to get him to be more disciplined and take on people right, like Kelly and start listening to the adults like McMaster and Mattis, and the fact that McMaster was able to fire Ezra Cohen Watnick, who was obviously being championed by Bannon but also being protected by Jared Kushner, would indicate perhaps that there's a change underway. But then the Bannon people are screaming to the rafters and telling the base through Breitbart and Fox that, you know, mm-hmm. that somehow Trump is abandoning his promise by being this reckless amateur. In other words, we like him as the reckless amateur destroyer, but the minute he starts being professional and competent, then the deep state has taken over.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Trump is a cult figure at this point, so I don't think anything that he does is going to tick off the base too much, unless, I suppose, he started saying that he was a great admirer of Hillary Clinton's or something. But, yeah, I mean, there are these fights inside. Oh, let me back up. I mean, you cannot compare Trump to any previous American presidency. You have to be Roman. You have to go back to the Roman. You have to go back to Caligula if you want to understand this administration and how it's operating. And what I mean by that is that there's going to be a lot of dramas inside the White House as well when you have this kind of leader. So, of course, there are going to be factions. Of course, there's going to be anger about all of that. What the Bannon people have, you know, on their side is, as you say, Ian, it's the base. And without the base, Trump is nothing. Without the threat that he holds over the Republicans, that, you know, if they go after him too hard, too fast, that he will pull his people. Well, that's what he's got, and Bannon knows that, and Bannon's going to keep them going. You know, Jared Kushner and Ivanka, I mean, they're more. You know, I mean, if this were The Godfather, I suppose Jared Kushner and Ivanka put together would be Michael Corleone. Okay, they're the young syndicate people who know what, you know, who know that the operation has to go in a different direction than it may have been already, and so that puts them at odds in many ways, as you say, Ian, with Steve Bannon. But, you know, it's still a recipe for chaos. And in the end, the tweeter is the man who's in charge. So it's going to be up to him to decide what happens.
Well, the thing that I mean, I get so much solicitation from right wingers to interview really ridiculous people saying ridiculous things. But you have to admit that the right wing is much more organized in terms of media than the left is. But the refrain that I'm getting now from all these offers to interview these people is they're all angry at McMaster, who they're blaming for leaking these transcripts. Uh-huh. And it's not even a subtext. What they're basically saying is that it's worse to tell the American people what's really going on in the White House than it is to cover it up. And I don't understand that conservative mindset. What's going on with the conservatives? Now, I recall when the Nixon tapes came out, that the scales came off people's eyes. They said, my God, I can't believe that this kind of foul language goes on in this hallowed place in the Oval Office. But what is that conservative impulse to want to cover up and blame the messenger for letting us know what the hell is going on at the highest level of our governance?
Well, the degree of cynicism on the part of the right wing is vast. It's vastly different than it was in 1973-74. I mean, you're not dealing with a situation in which there's honor and dignity and a legitimacy being attached to the presidency. I mean, this is another analogy is that these guys are kind of mafia Bolsheviks. I mean, you know, they're anything for power, and anything that gets in the way of their power, whether it's leaks or what have you, is something that has to be crushed, and they have to be given full authority and have to be respected, have to be loyal to do all of that. That's how we got here, in effect. I mean, the long, long breakdown in our politics and in the legitimacy of our politics and from 1973, right then actually, until now, is what gave us Trump in the first place. So Trump is the creature of what, you know, created him, and it's not surprising that you're going to see this. It's also a way to distract. I mean, there's a much more tactical point about all of this, right? I mean, you attack the messenger because you really hate the message, and you don't want the message to have credibility, so you distract from the message by saying the messenger's a creep, or by saying, as he always does, the other side does the same thing and then just as bad, which is something actually Nixon tried to do for every once in a while. So that every time, you know, he's getting, one of these leaks come out, he starts tweeting about how bad Hillary Clinton is and why we shouldn't be investigating Hillary Clinton. It's a means of distraction as much as it is anything else.
Well, throughout these transcripts, you see this constant. I mean, he is in his own world, and I did a little homework and talked to a bunch of businessmen who'd met with him over the years and said the one refrain that was constant was, this guy is nuts, this guy's in his own world, it's just amazing. Right. And people were quite appalled shaken by these meetings. So he's done very well and gotten a long way, but the transcripts keep talking about how great he is and this great victory. He keeps going back like Groundhog Day to the election, and he, of course, he thought he won New Hampshire when he didn't. It's just all over the place. But I spoke yesterday with one of the people that was high up in the National Security Council under Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a piece in yesterday's New York Times about how Trump is deliberately trying to undo the Obama's agreement with the P5+1 with Iran. Right. And this is definitely in the cards. And so there's two scenarios that we're heading towards. And in 90 days or less, Trump will find a way to get out of it and then resume sanctions and perhaps amp up tensions in the Gulf, and perhaps even start a war with Bannon's buddy, who's already in the Gulf, Eric Prince, the Blackwater guy, the brother of Betsy DeVos. So you have one of two scenarios. One is Mattis, McMaster, and even the new guy, Kelly, and Tillerson, who already apparently has told his friends he doesn't think he's going to last much longer in this White House. Right. They may take a walk. That's one scenario. The other scenario is that Trump may have his war with Iran, which would be even a greater catastrophe than the Iraq war. So what do you think the possibilities of this? You've already pointed out the politics of distraction that go on here, that how he, you know, riles up the base with these false promises, as he most recently did with the transgender thing, etc. Right. What about a real wag the dog situation where he has a war to distract them from his failure?
If the numbers go below... Yeah. If his numbers go below 30, what happens there? I mean, there will be a tipping point where he's going to have to worry that even the Republicans are going to have to give up on him because he's becoming so unpopular, or even his own shrink his own base might be shrinking. I don't know. It's very unpredictable, very scary to think what a president like that could do. And in a wartime situation, all sorts of constitutional issues come up then. I mean, you know, what happens to civil liberties, et cetera, here if we're under great attack or something like that? You know what I'm talking about. I mean, it can get very, very nasty. So, I'm very frightened about all of that. And, I kind of, whistle in the dark and say we'll get there when we get there. But I do think that in the larger scheme of things that, you know, I think you got it right when you talk about destruction. I mean, you know, Steve Bannon and those guys, that faction, if you will, they're a wrecking crew. I mean, take Steve Bannon at his word that he would like to destroy the administrative state, what he calls the administrative state, which most of us call the government of the United States. He would like to destroy it. He would like to break it down, take it apart, and take it down and sell it off for parts. And they can't do that legislatively so easily, but they are sure trying to do it in the departments. So this is not just the politics of destruction in the sense of ripping people down. This is actually destroying institutions, and in the extent to which certain institutions like the media are complicit are quite shocking. But institutions are under siege here. One other little point. I mean, you raised the thing about, you know, his joke about Hillary, about his obsession with the election, right? And how, you know, he has to prove that he won the popular vote. And there were all those lies about how there were these millions of voters out there who had voted for him, but they would have voted for him, but they got excluded because of corruption. Well, notice what's happened with that. They have now appointed a commission, which is having difficulty, but it's a commission that's meant to voter suppression commission. So off of his crazy tweets, right, off of his own egotism, comes plans that, comes ideas that would try and actually destroy institutions like the vote. That's what's so worrisome about this group of people in there, in that they are essentially destructive.
Well, obviously, the Koch brothers and others are getting what they want out of this administration. And that I don't know whether that's dovetails with Bannon. And Bannon's backer are the Mercers. God knows what they want out of the fact that they were the biggest donors to Trump and seem to have the most influence over the executive branch. It's very clear that the Koch brothers pretty much own Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and therefore the Congress, and they're getting everything, the oil pipelines, the end of the Paris Accords, the EPA wrecking crew. That's all happening to their benefit. But there's something else going on here, and of course we know how craven and disgusting the Republicans would be as enablers. But, for example, going back to that meeting that took place a while back when Kevin McCarthy told the House leadership with Paul Ryan in the room, saying basically, look, I swear to God that Donald Trump and Dana Rohrabacher are on Putin's payroll. And then they said, you know, let's not talk about it. Well, there was an independent witness in that who I know, the guy that ran for president, Evan McMullen, who witnessed that. And it was a serious remark. He wasn't joking. This is the number two guy in the House is telling the number one guy in the House that Trump is on Putin's payroll. Now, they've just voted overwhelmingly in the House and Senate to sanction Russia and Iran, with Trump's inability to override it, a huge signal to him. So is there something going on here? These enablers who clearly know that this guy's out to lunch, at what point are they going to show some patriotism?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, none of them was particularly happy with the Russia stuff in terms of policy. It's pretty bipartisan, and especially in the wake of the attack. But the attack is something that, you know, obviously Donald Trump wants people to not think about. And, you know, he is, you know, he looks very guilty, doesn't he? I mean, you know, he's acting like a guilty child around all that Russia stuff. So quite apart from the sanctions and policy, which I think is at the root of all of it, nevertheless, something happened back, you know, over the last 2 years between Trump and the Russians, and we have to get to the bottom of it. And that, in the end, I think, is the thing that's driving this more than anything else. Is, you know, the dry mouth that must affect Trump and the people around him when they think about Bob Mueller and what he might be doing. There's a report out today, in fact, that shows that Trump is actually going to be Mueller is going to be talking to interviewing high ups in the FBI, which people take to mean that he's really, you know, cracking down on the obstruction of justice charges and is really going after that pretty hard. You know, that could undo him in no uncertain terms. Of course, Trump doesn't act very well around all of this because he ends up getting into a fight with, of all people, Jeff Sessions, who's a friend of all of the people that he has to be, that hold his fate in his hands, in effect, in the Republican Congress. So it has a kind of wild character to it. But nevertheless, I do think, you know, in the end, that, or for now at any rate, it's the Russia investigation as much as anything else that really has Donald Trump worried.
Well, Sean Wilentz, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
I'm delighted as ever, and see you later.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Sean Wilentz, who's the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. His books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and Bob Dylan in America. And his latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with the American political historian, Alan Lichtman.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election, when against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. His latest book is The Case for Impeachment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And given the release of the transcripts from earlier conversations that Donald Trump had with world leaders shortly after he was inaugurated back in January, is the fact that these indicate an incredibly ignorant, delusional, unqualified president who barely has a command of the English language, is any of that impeachable?
Probably not impeachable per se, but it certainly adds to the context of impeachment. It's really important for everyone listening to understand that impeachment does not require an indictable crime. Impeachment is essentially a combined legal, political, and moral judgment. It is a judgment made by a political body, the United States House of Representatives, that has the sole authority for impeachment under the Constitution. And the framers explicitly did not put the power to impeach in the hands of the judiciary. So when you're dealing with the judgments of a political body, context matters, setting matters. And everything that Donald Trump says and does is part of the deliberations for impeachment. It might not directly affect what the special counsel is doing, which is a separate investigation. It's not an impeachment investigation, but it could very much affect what the U.S. House of Representatives does. Now, remember, the House is controlled by Trump's party, the Republicans. But it would only take, as I point out in my book, The Case for Impeachment, only some two dozen Republicans to join with Democrats for a House majority. And one of the Lichtman rules of politics is the first requisite of an office holder is survival. And this kind of ugly revelations from Donald Trump, at a time when his approval rating is already in the mid to low 30% range, is a warning signal to those members that Trump could be a liability to their political survival.
Well, it seems to me that this is a great American tragedy in a way. He's got this solid support, and admittedly, it's down to 33% now. And they voted for...
Yeah, it's looking a little more like applesauce than a solid mixture.
Right, but they're not wrong in wanting a change. Nobody's wrong, I think, in believing that the political establishment that we've had for decades has not necessarily performed well. So on the one hand, you know, his supporters seem to like the idea that he's breaking the China, but they don't understand that he's incredibly ignorant. It's on the one hand, it's not a bad idea to question the logic of why things are done and why business as normal is the way to go. But on the other hand, when you read these transcripts, you realize this guy is woefully ignorant of just all of the parameters of any reasonable discussion.
Well, that's right. And here's what's worse. He's not just ignorant. He doesn't care. It's not as if, okay, I really don't know much about international relations. I don't know much about policy making, healthcare, you name it, but I can learn. I can learn on the job. There's none of that. He doesn't care. He doesn't want to learn. It doesn't matter to him one way or another. As I point out in the case for impeachment, if you look at his 40-plus years of history before the White House, as a business person, as a TV star, he cared about one and only one thing, and that was Donald Trump. Everybody else was collateral damage, whether it's the contractors he stiffed or the people that were left holding the bag when he declared bankruptcy or investors in his many failed buildings like the condo towers in Fort Lauderdale and Tampa, Florida. They didn't matter. Plus, truth, logic, evidence makes utterly no difference to Donald Trump. Again, in my book, I point this out, that throughout his career, through the presidency, truth to Donald Trump, knowledge to Donald Trump, was what he believes at the moment and what serves his interests at the moment. So you and I and others can criticize him, point out his ignorance, point out his vulgarity, and it doesn't matter to him. You can't shame him. As long as he can still go to West Virginia and get adoring crowds, none of the rest of it matters to him. And that's critically important to understand. There's no learning curve here.
But it's one thing for him to be completely obsessed with himself and have no concern about anybody else and had absolutely no relationship with the truth. And facts and evidence don't matter to him, as you pointed out. Why is it, though, that his supporters feel the same way? Why is it that facts and evidence do not matter to them?
Yeah. First of all, you got to understand, most people don't follow politics all that closely. They don't follow the ins and outs. They don't fact check what is said. And Trump is a master practitioner of what I called in the case for impeachment, the big lie, you know, the favorite technique of dictators. If you say something, regardless of its relationship to the truth, and you're in a position of authority, and you repeat it over and over and over again, it sticks. What was absolutely extraordinary was this recent poll, Morning Consult Politico, which showed about half of Trump's voters believed that he won the popular vote, even though he lost the popular vote by 2.9 million voters. The other thing, you put your finger on it, and this was also the reason I was able to predict a Donald Trump victory. It was not because of Donald Trump, but because I believed that the American people were indeed ready for a change, that they were unhappy with the establishment of both parties. They were unhappy with the incumbent administration, which they felt hadn't fully served their needs. We saw that played out in the Democratic primaries. Who would have imagined that Bernie Sanders, you know, someone who no one ever heard of, you know, a man in his 70s, could have given Hillary Clinton such a battle? And that's why Donald Trump won the presidency, because people wanted something new. And at least his base supporters are not willing to give that up yet. They are still hoping, you know, that Donald Trump will shake things up in a way that serves their interests. Plus, he's pretty shrewd at doing things that appeal to the base, even though they have no hope of being put into policy, such as this new immigration plan to slash our immigration policies by half and change the basis for letting people into this country. That's never going to happen, but his base loves it. Or the attorney general, who he, in a very phony way, attacked. He loves Jeff Sessions, let me tell you, because Jeff Sessions represents what his base stands for. Jeff Sessions saying he's going after affirmative action. You know, that's not going to mean much, but again, it is something that appeals to the base.
Well, but you could jerk their chain for a while, but not forever. I mean,
that's right.
I don't understand, right, though, and I know we've spoken way back when you were making these predictions that Trump would win against all odds. But I did some homework, as you clearly have done in your book, Alan Lichtman, The Case for Impeachment. I did some homework when it became clear that he was the nominee. And then when he became president, I talked to a bunch of businessmen that had dealings with him. And the one thing that in common with all of the people I talked to was that they felt when they met with this guy, they were appalled. And they basically all said, this guy is in his own world. And these transcripts that were released today by the Washington Post of these early conversations with world leaders clearly indicate that this guy is in his own world.
And you know what? They indicate a couple of other things that are really important. First of all, they indicate he doesn't care anything about policy. He doesn't care about how people are affected. He doesn't really care about the wall as a wall. He only cares about the wall because that's part of his political appeal. He said, you know, the wall is really unimportant. You know, I don't really care if Mexico pays for it or not, but you can't keep saying that because that makes me look bad. I can't take in these refugees for Australia, regardless of, you know, their situation, because that would make me look bad. The other thing that is so striking is his irascible relationships with Australia and Mexico, two of our most important allies, while at the same time he's cozying up in these early conversations and even later to some of the world's worst dictators, not just Vladimir Putin of Russia, but Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines, who is tabbed as one of the worst human rights violators in the world, who is likely responsible for the deaths of many thousands of his own people. He seems to get along better with these awful dictators than he does with democratic allies.
Well, so do you see then, you've got Pence running around the world saying the opposite, Trump is obviously, you know, he had that private meeting with Putin where they made sure there was no record of what was said. And the fact that the House and Senate voted overwhelmingly for these sanctions against a number of countries, but mostly against Russia, is a clear indication that they don't trust this guy.
No, I think they're off the reservation. And his base will not hold forever. It's already beginning to erode. In these latest polls, you can see his Republican numbers going down. And while they will give him some time, they will not give him indefinite time. It's going to end at some particular point. And you're absolutely right. Most of the responsible Republicans in the Senate, less so in the House, realize Trump is driving the bus off the cliff. Not only in foreign policy, but he's pursuing some very dangerous things, but in domestic policy as well. Look at the health care debate. He had no idea what was in that bill. All he cared about was getting a win. He's willing to let Obamacare implode and let people lose their health care just to get a win.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Alan Lichtman.
My great pleasure. Take care.
You too. And I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election when, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. His latest book is The Case for Impeachment. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined in the studio by the director of the new explosive documentary from Netflix, Icarus.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way. taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Brian Fogel, who prior to directing his first documentary feature, co-wrote and starred in the hit international and off-Broadway play Jewtopia, and co-wrote and directed the feature film adaptation. He is the writer, director, and producer of a new film that opens tomorrow on Netflix, Icarus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Fogel.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian, sometimes people put themselves in their own movies for the wrong reasons, and or put their girlfriends in their movies too, right? But you put yourself in this movie for the right reason and a very courageous reason, which is really how you've revealed this extraordinary doping system in Russia that has eventually led to the main character in your film being in witness protection here in the United States. It's also revealed the depth of corruption in Russia all the way up to Putin, because the head of the Russian Sports Federation, Putin, after all of this stuff that you reveal in your film, which is just breathtakingly incriminating, this guy ends up as what, a deputy prime minister?
Yes, the deputy prime minister of Russia, which is essentially the vice president.
So, you know, I try to cover the Russian story, which is clearly making life difficult for Donald Trump. But I do, and I suspect this happens to you, get an extraordinary amount of hate mail. Now, a lot of it's generated by Russian troll farms. So, and we get hacked all the time, and we have to do a lot of proactive stuff because they've targeted me, along with the people that I interview, like Masha Gessen and others who actually know about Russia and are Russians. And Nina Khrushcheva, the granddaughter of the former Soviet leader. So, you know, I like to talk to Russians about Russia. And I find it extraordinary that critics on the left in this country and people like Oliver Stone and the editors of The Nation magazine seem to be so blind and so subservient to Putin, but they don't seem to have any sense of solidarity with the Russian people, particularly these young Russians, teenagers, high school kids who are taken to the streets and getting beaten up by Putin's police. So I take it you're getting it criticized because of what the film reveals as being anti-Russian, in the same way that I'm getting criticized for simply covering what is pretty much the story of the day in terms of Trump and possible Russian collusion.
Yeah, there was a pretty big and inflammatory story in RT, the Russian Times, a couple days ago, talking about Grigory Rodchenkov as Dr. Death, and then it got into detail attacking me and that this was all about money and this was, you know, America's intention to defrock Russia and this is American propaganda, et cetera, et cetera. But personal attacks on myself and Grigory. And but it seems to be par for the course, essentially to deny and then to then try to attack someone on a personal level to try to discredit them, which is, I guess, not shocking, but in regards to even everything that I uncovered with the film and, you know, what is thousands of pieces of evidence, there has still been a blatant denial in Russia and still trying to pin this onto Grigory as an individual when this operation was a huge scandal of epic proportions that involved the participation of the FSB, the KGB, thousands of Russian athletes and a system that had been in place, according to Gregory, essentially since the advent of steroids in the late 60s and throughout all of Olympic history.
And throughout Soviet history.
So, yes.
So let's talk about the film then in terms of you're the main character along with Dr. Gregory Rodchenkov, right?
Yes.
And you start out as an amateur bike racer, cyclist, right? But you want to enhance and improve your abilities, right? And you go to UCLA, you get turned down. So walk us through, because it seems like there's three parts of the movie. Your story, and then the introduction of the doctor, and then how he becomes the whistleblower, and how they come after him, and how they lie. The entire Russian system just lies in the most blatant way. And then eventually the whistleblower, Dr. Gregory Rodchenkov, ends up in witness protection where he is today.
You know, first off, the movie that I ended up making was not the movie that I set out to make. And the journey of this film really started 4 years ago and is still unfolding. So many of the ramifications of what is uncovered in the film still have not settled. There's still so many unanswered questions about it. But when I began the film, it came from really two places. One is my passion for cycling. I'd grown up racing bikes, and whenever I wasn't riding or doing, you know, entertainment projects, I took to the bike, and that's been my lifelong passion. And part of that was inevitably the discussion for many, many, many years among everybody I rode with. Did Lance dope? Did he not dope? Who's doping?
Lance Armstrong.
And it was this constant topic of conversation, but also in the media as well. And so, you know, he confesses in January 2013. And the amazing part behind this is the USADA, the United States Anti-Doping Agency, and WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, and various anti-doping agencies around the world and the sports world are, you know, basically heralding this spectacular success that they had finally caught Lance Armstrong. But they didn't catch Lance Armstrong, not how they were supposed to catch Lance Armstrong. To this day, Lance is still clean. He passed 500 anti-doping controls clean. So I'm going, wait, you didn't catch Lance Armstrong. This is like the equivalent of getting Al Capone on tax evasion. And not only that, the only way that they're finally able to catch Lance Armstrong is to get all of his teammates to rat him out, who did the exact same thing that he did, in exchange for their own immunity as part of a federal investigation into whether or not Lance Armstrong doped. So literally there's a criminal investigation being launched into whether or not this guy's dopes. And the only way that they're able to get him, after science has failed miserably over 500 tests, is to get his teammates, who did the exact same thing as he did and didn't get caught, to rat him out. So I'm going, wait, wait, wait. What is wrong with this system? Not what is wrong with Lance Armstrong, because I'm going, hey, if I was Lance Armstrong and I understand the science and I understand what's at stake and I understand what winning means and I believe that everybody else is doing it, which it has now been made public and proven that everybody else of his generation was doing the same thing he was. Well, if I believed that I could win, well, why wouldn't I do that? So I was looking at this more of a perspective of what is wrong with the system, not as what is wrong with these athletes and what is wrong with Lance. And so I start talking to all these scientists, and every one of them, I say, does the anti-doping system work? And they go, no. I go, do you believe the anti-doping system will ever work? And they go, no. And I go, what's wrong with the anti-doping system? And that would launch into an hour conversation of 10,000 things. And then I would say, well, do you think it's possible for an athlete to essentially do what Lance did and still not be caught? And they would say, yes. And I said, would you be able to tell me how to do this and advise me? And they would generally say yes. And then I'd say, well, would you do this for me on camera? And they would say no. And after all these conversations with so many people, I got this idea that, hey, I was going to make this movie where I was going to turn myself into a human guinea pig, essentially supersize me it, but nobody had seen this. I was going to dope myself. I was incredibly curious as just on a personal level what these drugs, hormones would do for my cycling ability and what they would do for me. And behind that, I was going to explore the anti-doping system. And to me, the ramifications were so much bigger than cycling, which was, what does this mean for all of sport if the actual anti-doping system is an invalid? And that was the movie that I set out to make. And what transpired became a very, very different film.
And again, I'm joined in the studio by Brian Fogel, who, prior to directing his first documentary feature, co-wrote and starred in the hit international and off-Broadway play, Zootopia, and co-wrote and directed the feature film adaptation. He is the writer, director, and producer of the new film out tomorrow, Friday, on Netflix, Icarus. So the film goes from your, what you just explained to us, because what we're talking about here is how the systems, how you cheat the system. It's all about the science of cheating as opposed to the science, right?
Right.
And then walk us through the second section of the film, which is the Russian doctor.
So I set out on this journey, and the whole thing for me to be able to have success is I need an advisor, basically a scientist, and I need to get my samples into a WADA lab, a World Anti-Doping Agency lab. And there's 33 of these labs in the world, at least I think that's the number, it might be a couple more. And these labs essentially are in control of all of the testing for all international competition in sport that does drug testing. And these labs are very highly regulated and controlled. And so you can't just go get your sample tested through a lab, because if you could, right, and you could just get your samples into a lab, well, you could figure out where the fallacies in the system were. And so these labs are very closely monitored. And I get connected to Dr. Gregory Rodchenkov through Don Catlin, who is...
And he's the head of the Russian... What was his position?
Dr. Rodchenkov at the time is running the third largest WADA laboratory in the world. And he is the chief of this WADA lab. And this lab had overseen the testing for the Sochi Olympics, had overseen the testing of all...
It's in Russia, right?
Yeah, in Moscow.
That's what I mean, yeah.
It's the Moscow laboratory. And this laboratory is one of the newest, most state-of-the-art laboratories in the world, because Russia poured, I don't know the dollar amount, tens of millions of dollars into this laboratory in preparation for the Sochi Olympics, and also, you know, for all the international competitions coming into Russia. And so this laboratory is the single lab that is doing the testing for all of Russian sport, all of Russian athletes, for the Sochi Olympics, and all international competitions that come into Russia, whether that's the swimming competitions or track and field competitions, right, or tennis, or
the upcoming World Cup.
Or upcoming World Cup. It's right. This laboratory that handles it. And Gregory is the head of this laboratory, and I connect with him, and he agrees to help advise me how to dope, what to take, when to take it, and also agrees that he'll help smuggle my urine back to his laboratory in Moscow for testing, to basically figure out a protocol for me of when I'll be clean, when I would test.
Which is clean is how you avoid the test.
Exactly.
That's what's so Orwellian about this whole thing, right? again, it's the science of cheating as opposed using science to cheat science. Is that how would you describe it?
I mean, that is a great analogy, and we certainly really latched onto Orwell in the film because everything of the story on so many levels is Orwellian. It's doublethink. It's using science to cheat science. It's pretending to be anti-doping, but you're really doping. It's saying, you know, one thing and, you know, being the venom and the anti-venom.
But the net result is that all of the Russian athletes were doing it, right? And once this guy blew the whistle, he unraveled Sochi, he unraveled the entire Russian sports system, and people start dropping dead, right? I mean, this is serious business. This guy's in big jeopardy.
Yeah. It essentially, the information that he had and the system that he was involved in, you know, you have to remember that, like in the United States, sports is essentially a private enterprise. All of our teams are privately owned, you know, so if you own the Los Angeles Lakers or the Denver Broncos, they are privately held teams. In Russia, all of sports is under the ministry, meaning it is a government operation, and the government oversees sports. And the Russian athletes essentially are employees of the government. So it's a very, very different system how it works there. And so Grigory was overseeing essentially the doping control for all of Russian sport. And according to him, essentially, there was no anti-doping in Russia. The entire system was put up as a front to make it look like there was anti-doping, but everything that was going on at the laboratory level and the science level was to evade positive detection and to advise the Russian athletes how to do that, and if they were indeed positive, to conceal their results. And that goes into a much more elaborate discussion. But the bottom line of it is that this guy was essentially, as he says, the mastermind, the overseer of the entire Russian sports system in regards to whether or not an athlete would test positive and clean, right, and advising
that athlete.
The
whole system based on cheating. That's the bottom line.
The entire system based on cheating.
Performance enhancement that you disguise. So it's not a level playing field, because the whole point of trying to get rid of doping is to say that everybody's on a level playing field. But if you've got steroids and other whatever these sophisticated treatments are, you have an unfair advantage. That's at the heart of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's
unsportsmanlike conduct, I believe, is
yeah. There's a deeper conversation, I think, you know, where you look at like the doping or anti-doping or the level playing field of it, and so there's the game which you can say that everybody is playing, which is the game of science, which is, okay, there's a new product coming on the market. I read yesterday that some athlete, some cyclist just tested positive for some drug. I don't remember the name of it, but apparently it treats liver disease, but it's been found to, you know, enhance performance. I don't know the details behind this. And this drug was not on the banned substance list until just like yesterday, kind of thing. Right. And so there's the constant, you know, cat and mouse game of what's on the list, what's not on the list, what you can take, when you can take it, how fast it clears your body. And that's never going to change. Right. And that is, I think, part of the system. Then there is just the outright criminal fraud. And there's a difference between those two. So you can make the argument of a quote-unquote level playing field if you're evading science and kind of doing the Lance Armstrong of it, which is, well, everybody else is doing it and I'm doing it and we're all, you know, manipulating the system, versus what Russia put into place after the London Olympics really had nothing to do with science. What they started doing was literally having their athletes just dope through competition, because they had figured out how to break in to these urine collection bottles the FSB developed a technique that they were able to break into these impenetrable bottles developed through a Swiss company that are basically the bank vault of the anti-doping system. And they figure out how to break into these bottles.
The samples.
The collection samples.
And the FSB, of course, being the successor agency to the KGB.
Yes.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, there were a number of Russians, apparently senior FSB, former KGB guys, including Ivanov, Putin's chief of staff, who clearly told him that meddling in the American elections was a dangerous thing to do and you may suffer blowback. And he's clearly suffering blowback now. But people did die. A bunch of senior KGB guys have died mysteriously. The same thing's happening in your story. And let's get to the ending here because we're running out of time. But because the last third of the movie is just breathtaking. It is so amazing to see these brazen lies, just a blizzard of lies, and to see the really bad people promoted as now the deputy prime minister, Putin's number two guy, his vice president. It's unbelievable.
It's everything that happened in the fallout of this story, from literally Richard McLaren releases this report in July, and every anti-doping agency in the world and most sporting federations in the world are calling for Russia to be banned from the Rio Games. And then Thomas Bach, who is a well-known, very close friend of Putin, essentially passed the buck to the federations and didn't ban Russia from Rio, despite, you know, this spectacular evidence. I mean, literally, it was like uncovering Auschwitz and then the IOC turning the other way and going, this isn't our responsibility to take action against it. To seeing the Russian reaction to this, which is to deny, to deny, to deny. And then to see this Orwellian system in place where the little guy is pushed under the bus. The main guy that Grigory is answering to, Nagornov, is forced to resign and he's under criminal investigation. Where the guy who Nagornov is answering to, Mutko, who's the sports minister who Grigory was also in communication with, is elevated to essentially the vice president of Russia to get out of harm's way. To Putin sitting on state television, despite Grigory having dominated Russian news for the last year, the audacity to go on state television and go, I don't even remember this guy's name. I don't even remember the lab director's name. Yet this man has been on front pages of Russian media for the last year. And to then have a president say he doesn't even remember his name, it speaks to this just scary moment in history. And we're seeing this reflected in our own country right now, which is shocking, which I could have never imagined as I went into this film, what the current political situation would be, and that we're finding ourselves back in this Cold War era.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I wish we had more time, Brian Fogel, but your film opens Friday, tomorrow on Netflix, Icarus. And again, I've been joined in the studio by Brian Fogel, who prior to directing his first documentary feature film, co-wrote and starred in the hit international and off-Broadway play, Jewtopia, and co-wrote and directed the feature film adaptation. And he's the writer, director, and producer of the new film out tomorrow, Friday, on Netflix, Icarus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.